Hello, 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 divas and hustlers. Welcome to another episode of Hidden Apron Radio. This is episode 11. My name is Paulo Espanola, and thank you for listening. So the episode today is a bit different. If you've been following the previous 10 episodes, you know most of the time we're interviewing someone interesting, someone who has made moves in the food industry, changing it for the better, and helping us try to understand how can we develop a better relationship with food, whether that's knowing how to cook, understanding what we eat better, trying to peer into the murky back room of how the food industry actually works, and talking to these experts, you could say, other than just like the three-star chef that you would normally see on TV. So the episode is a little bit different in that it's been quite a while since I've done one of these where I'm basically the only one ranting and raving on it, primarily because there's no shortage of amazing people who are doing great things in the food space, right? Whether they're a farmer, advocate, or cook. And we started this podcast to share these people's stories as a way to hopefully help people develop that better relationship with food and trying to see how our food decisions impact our lives and, you know, on the whys and the hows and the what's of cooking. And while we've covered a pretty wide range of topics in the last 10 episodes, I want to make sure we don't forget the actual nitty-gritty part of getting in the kitchen and firing up the stoves, right? Because otherwise, this stuff is just in our head and isn't actually making its way into the real world. So today, I've actually get down to the strategies that you can start using immediately, right? These are quick things that anyone can use right away to become a more competent cook. So what are some of the things that I've done as I've gone on this journey of being able to connect with my food a little more? And hopefully you can take some of these into your kitchens with minimal startup costs, so to speak. So it just so happens that I actually spoke on this topic about a week ago at my day job. So I thought, you know, might as well just share the content here. There's an accompanying deck that actually went along with this presentation here. So I'll try to upload it by the time you hear this podcast on the website. But don't feel like you actually need it for any of this to make sense. I tried to cut down as much fat from this episode so I could keep it in my diet. Ha! Anyway, bad jokes. So I'd definitely love to hear your feedback on this one, especially since this is something that I kind of culled together from various sources and synthesized into this Frankenstein approach. And so as always, you can follow along at hiddenapron.com or send us an email at hiddenapron@gmail.com. So I'd like to start the story today with a bunch of disclaimers, right? We know that food is extremely personal, and there's a reason why people can get a bit miffed when you talk about how one can eat or should eat. With that said, this is not going to be a moralizing episode. I won't be presenting the one right way to eat, nor will I be making a lot of opinion-based arguments. Honestly, if you're satisfied with the way you eat today and you have absolutely no qualms, by all means, go ahead, right? If you're happy with the way you eat, more power to you. Instead, this episode is really for those who want to start cooking or deepening their relationship to food but feel really overwhelmed and just don't know where to start. Perhaps maybe you've caused too many a kitchen disaster, or your food just isn't fitting into your health goals, or you know, you have 3 day jobs and you're trying to find a way to fit food in there somewhere and just are not sure how. Well, in that case, listen on. This is also not going to be about health, or at least it won't be directly. It can certainly lead to a healthier lifestyle, but I think health is, it's a bit of a loaded term in that we're led to believe that there's this one path to it. And in reality, people differ when it comes to their definition of health. And not just because, you know, from a biological standpoint, we kind of develop these differences across cultures and ethnicities and our diets, right? So I'm going to avoid all that for now and really focus more on the principles rather than the specific things you should or shouldn't be eating. So on that note, focusing on principles, I also won't be covering so-called BuzzFeed listicles. You know what I mean? Like the ones that say like the top 5 techniques you never knew you needed, or the number 3 superfoods you should be cooking with now. Stuff that sounds like that. And reason being that, again, I want to try to focus on finding a system or a framework that can be applied to the largest number of scenarios, whether you're a busy mom, whether you're a teen who's just about to go into college, rather than these like niche tactics. And they make great clickbait, but they aren't really actionable in real life. Finally, as those of you who follow our story know, this is not just for current cooks and those of us who are like uber obsessed with the kitchen, right? This is for everybody. Even I don't cook 7 times a week. Many of us at Hidden Apron weren't professionally trained. Most of us had to learn it by fire and hot grease. And thus, I'm going to focus more on the minimum viable solution, or like the greatest common denominator, you could say. That means some of this stuff really will be like no duh content. In fact, a lot of this stuff, it's not even original. As I said, I've called this from various other places, including people who have been cooking for decades, right? So many other cooks throughout the centuries, including our grandparents, have cooked in the manner that I'm actually going to present, albeit it's a bit less explicitly stated. But that's kind of the point. I think oftentimes we're victim to what Ramit Sethi, he's a great writer and speaker on topics like finance, job search, that I would recommend you read, unrelated to food, what he calls the smart person syndrome. It's where we nod our heads on something we feel is pretty obvious, but end up actually not executing on it. So for an example, working out and flossing. Like, we all know we should probably do this, but for some reason we still kind of forget to do it, or we lapse on it, or we just like cannot bring ourselves to do it. So I'm gonna say it again. Some of this stuff is going to be painfully obvious, but it just means we should be all the more conscious of whether we're actually practicing it in our day-to-day if we kind of agree with the logic behind it. I think one thing that's been really helpful when trying to actually practice things that are susceptible to the smart person syndrome is setting the actual practice in context, especially a historical context. Because if we can understand the reasoning behind doing something, we're more likely to follow through. So to start us off, here are a few things I found just from reading various sources, especially a very insightful book that I actually found by chance in the basement of my previous apartment. Someone must have left it there. I think he was like a copy editor, and he got like an advanced copy of this book. It's called Three Squares by Abigail Carroll, and it talks about how eating evolved in the U.S. from pre-colonial times all the way to today. So why start here? Well, by knowing how and why we eat today, we can form a basis for why we should and cook tomorrow. So just keep in mind that some of this stuff is specific to the U.S., mainly because I've been here for the last 10 years, but I think some of these principles are, you could see parallels in other places. And the biggest thing I took away from this informal research of mine is how industry, particularly during the Industrial Revolution here in the U.S., has influenced our meal times and practices. So prior to the advent of manufacturing, the concept of lunch, right, and that's something we kind of take for granted as always existing, it actually didn't exist. People, what they called dinner, or their main heaviest meal, was actually around noon when it got hot around the farms. And so they ate a lighter meal of leftovers for supper when it got dark, when we usually think dinner would happen. So this ritual or practice obviously became impractical when factories were built, and they were built further from the home, and people worked nonstop for a wage. And, you know, this was before the enactment of labor laws, right? So people working inhumane hours with barely any breaks. So for people to actually go back home and eat a heavy meal in the middle of the day was just not going to work. So people actually had to bring these lighter, colder meals to work versus the hot, heavier ones. In order to make sure that productivity was still there, some places actually constructed lunchrooms and cafeterias. So now people didn't even have to leave work, right? They could just like move to this room, eat, and then go back real quick. And I think this kind of made concrete this question that I've always been asking when I came here to the States, of like, why don't people eat lunch like they do where I came from, where like you would even have a nap right after? And as time went on, it made sense, right? Lunch became more and more concrete, and several characteristics of the American lunch became solidified. There was the brown bag lunch, the lunch tin, the diner counter, the power lunch. Like, these are all aspects of lunch that we now kind of readily identify with it. And these power lunches, for example, where, yeah, they might be sitting for an hour enjoying a three-course meal, but they were talking about work, right? These deals were regularly discussed over food. Marketing. People started advertising foods that were supposed to prevent indigestion and food comas and increase your productivity. And all of these were in response, essentially, it was a driving force that industry and productivity trump food. And really, why should that be a surprise, right? Lunch, unlike in other places, arose as a response to a change in the work environment. And so people didn't really have an emotional connection to the idea of eating during lunch times here in America. And I even remember hearing someone at work many years ago, right? So if any coworkers of mine are listening to this now, this does not apply to you. I remember her expressing how frustrated she was that her father could even think of inviting her to an hour lunch in the middle of a workday. She was like, oh my God, I have like work. Like, does he not understand that? And it just boggled my mind. Why was that mindset there? And then this book kind of put it in a good context. So I think this sort of food versus work mentality extended further into what we call dinner today. You know, dinner in the mid 90s, early 90s was seen as a kind of refuge, or 1900, sorry, because I really mean like the 40s, 50s, 60s. It was seen as a kind of refuge since it now was the main and many times only meal where families could reconnect. So dinner became this very American way of like preserving the family lifestyle, right? And trying to instill values during dinner. And you'll see a lot of articles decrying the decline of the family dinner more so than the lunch, right? Because there's a bigger emotional connection to it. Dinner, however, shifted as women entered the workforce. Advances in marketing, packaging, manufacturing, the health industry, they focused on foods that cut down on prep time. It prioritized efficiency rather than the actual ritual of cooking at dinner instead. So the result, after decades of doing this, is basically a population that is slowly forgetting how to cook. It's inundated with huge forces, whether it's advertising or government telling it how to cook, what to cook, and it's overwhelmed with these options, right? So now, of course, all of this is an oversimplification because I'm trying to condense, you know, basically hundreds of years worth of changes into a couple of minutes of background. But what I'd like to basically focus on is one question from all this, is how can we gain the benefits associated with cooking while still addressing the market realities of too little time, too little money, way too much information, right? Because I'm not calling for us to go back to the days where we spent 4 hours in the morning cooking everything from scratch in time for like a midday meal. That's not where I'm going at all. But let's start first with the benefits. As I mentioned, there's some benefits associated. Why should we even bother cooking? Because with restaurants, takeout windows, delivery systems like Seamless being a major supplier of our meals, I think we actually get over 50% of our meals in America from outside sources. Do we really need to cook? Can't we just dispense of it as an archaic concept and focus on the things we actually want to accomplish? Like, I don't know, maybe our day job or our passion project or our side hustle. I think especially as the value of your time increases, cooking becomes more and more expensive when you factor how much time you're actually spending planning, shopping, preparing your food. However, the benefits of that far exceed the perceived cost, especially when, as later on, I can show you how you can address those costs of time and money. For one, cooking prevents you from succumbing to inaccurate or even worse, deceptive messages around food. I saw this report. It was released in 2013, and it used methodology from the Yale Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, and it showed that the fast food industry alone, so we're not even counting processed food or the foods that are all like canned and jarred in your grocery markets that you can use to like heat up for TV dinners, right? The fast food industry alone spent $4.2 billion on marketing, some to kids as young as three. And so just to give a sense of scale, because $4.2 billion sounds like, I don't, like, what do we compare that with, right? For example, take McDonald's, which is the biggest advertiser of fast food in America. They spent 2.7 times more money to advertise their products compared to all the fruit, vegetable, water, and milk advertisers combined. Like, just to give you a sense of scale, that is huge. And this is increasingly targeting kids, by the way, primarily Black and Hispanic. despite many fast food places or processed food places proclaiming that they now have these healthy options, less than 1%, it was found by this study, of all the possible meal combinations actually even met nutritional standards. So, I mean, fast food aside, because I think a lot of us kind of understand the dangers of eating too much fast food, much of marketing is actually never really clear, because that's kind of the point. You know, if we were to assume that all human beings are rational, you know, if we think of like economics, right, and that they would make rational decisions, an ad for fast food or processed food would simply say what it is. This is a serving of fries. It has this much fat. It has this much salt. And we could make our own decision whether we want to buy it or not. Instead, we show a bunch of happy, thin, laughing people doing something cool, eating fries. Because that's the point, right? Companies want you to eat their food. And if they can get you to make an irrational decision to buy it, well, you know, there's a bit of a conflict of interest here if you're not cooking. Another thing, too, is that companies and government, what they say about our food is many times not really clearly understood, and you know, it's not like a one-to-one relationship. So here's an example, right? Organic food, it's a big loaded term nowadays. Did you know that food labeled made with organic can actually contain up to 30% non-organic ingredients, including certain pesticides that are on an approved list? Or take the term cage-free, right? Big term for eggs, cage-free eggs. It actually doesn't necessarily mean that your chicken that you bought for your eggs or for your meat is raised on this like wide green pasture free to roam around. Their only requirement is that they have access to the outdoors. So if I put a little tiny trap door that leads from this like enclosure to a gravel road, I can satisfy the cage-free requirement. And like this happens all the time. And that's just ingredients. In schools, right, we've also skewed our policies so much that there was this ridiculous thing that was passed a few years ago that made pizza actually considered a vegetable because of the tomato sauce on it. Let's not even mention how much sugar is in the tomato sauce, but vegetable's a vegetable, I suppose, and pizza is now considered a serving of vegetable. Another one, and I swear I'll like cut off on this because there's so many examples. We've actually convinced people on the wonders of gluten-free water. Like, there's literally water that's marketed as gluten-free. Like, when did water ever have gluten to begin with? So if we think about all those examples, it kind of certainly makes everything we eat seem just a bit more suspect. So second reason, lower costs as a benefit to cooking. Going back to the misconception that cooking is expensive, given that a $15 takeout meal is cheaper than all the groceries you have to buy in amounts that you may have to store, plus the value of time. So eating out in the long run, when I really think about it, can actually be more expensive. Reason being that there are negative indirect costs that I don't think we think about when we order takeout or eat out. So research has shown that eating out or ordering in actually causes you to eat more in overall calories, one, as well as things like saturated fat, sodium, right? They did this whole study of comparing foods that you could buy from outside versus if you're just cooking your own. If so, then the potential healthcare costs due to an unhealthy diet down the road should really be factored in when you're deciding on your dining options, right? I know this is admittedly challenging, given that like these negative health effects are often very vague and they're way too far out in our thinking and our foresight to be visceral enough to cause any like behavioral change. But the bottom line though here is that cooking is definitely cheaper, factoring in all the costs. Last reason, your dining decisions affect more than just you and your gut. Cooking and valuing food can literally save the planet. Like, this is not an exaggeration. Because with the further commercialization of food, we basically created systems that are optimized for efficiency, palatability, and profitability. It's why we subsidize crops like corn and soybean rather than fresh fruits and vegetables, which, even though we're told to eat, are not subsidized, and so it appears more expensive. By the way, fruits and vegetables are considered specialty crops, and that's why they're not as subsidized. The other thing, too, our farmers are increasingly getting older. If you listen to the episode with Eric Sanrud, who's a hops farmer in Minnesota, he talks about this extensively. Farms are being consolidated into bigger farms run by fewer people, and as an end consumer, I might say, oh, okay, cool. That makes things cheaper, especially if my diet's comprised of subsidized food. But there's something to be said here about risk, right? Because even though there's economies of scale, what if one crop fails? And this has happened before. Without diversified crops, small farms, a healthy food system, we could really be in some deep shit in the future. Another thing that Eric said on that podcast episode was that everyone kind of knows that no farmers equal no food, but fewer farmers also equal crappier food. So if we're not cooking and prioritizing these products that farmers are making, they will disappear or be more scarce, and we actually put our food system in danger because of our food choices. So just to recap, because I know I've ranted on this long enough, dining in America has changed. We're cooking less, we're eating alone more, but we've got just a little bit more of the jury stuff before we go into the tactics. Like I said, it's all about context, right? So I want to make sure we spend enough time on setting the context before making any of the tactical decisions, because that's what really drives the real change, having a basis of understanding. So let's assume a good scenario that you agree with one of the benefits I listed, not counting many of the other benefits such as better relationships, more control over meals, smarter families. These are all research-backed. There's still some very big and very valid reasons why you still would not cook. And these are the reasons I'll actually try to address specifically with the strategies and methods that I'm going to cover, and I promise I'll get to them. So for one reason that you're probably not going to cook is I completely blame mainstream media on this one. However well-intentioned they are, is that you don't have the right skills. And worse, TV and the internet have convinced you that these skills can either only be acquired by buying certain equipment or classes, or some host makes a technique look deceptively simple, that when you try doing it at home, you end up failing and you get discouraged, and you know what I mean? So this issue of skills, I think, is a bit skewed in our minds. So what do I mean by that? So, for example, you know, if you watch those TV shows, those cute little, like, glass bowls where they have everything separated, like, they have their onions chopped, they have parsley, and they have, like, 20 of them all lined up on the table. Who actually owns all that or even has space for that, right? And we don't think of, like, all the chopping that went into play before they even put them into the bowls. Like, seriously, who has a line of, like, say, pots and pans or, like, huge sinks that don't show the pile of dishware you have to clean? A 6-range stove, a 2-level oven, freezer that could fit your crazy neighbor's 20 cats in, right? There's a lot of stuff that are in these shows that the normal person does not have. And let's not even start on how many roast chickens they already have on the side so they can just switch to a pre-cooked one once the cameras start rolling. Like, this is a production. It's a show. And so you don't really stand a chance when you're trying to compare yourself to that. Second reason, and I mentioned this earlier, is no time. And I think this is the biggest reason that I often hear when I ask people, like, why don't you cook? And even this is the biggest reason when I decide not to cook on certain days. And it's quite glaring in the U.S. today, especially in, like, the urban jungles like New York. So just to give you a sense, the average American spends just 30 minutes a day preparing meals. 30 total. That's it. That's how much time I'd need to cook, like, one meal from scratch. The average American also spends only 75 minutes a day eating food. So if we put that in contrast, the French and many other countries take up to 2.5 hours a day to eat. Another interesting fact, the percent of meals eaten with others in the US, only 20%. That means 80% of the time we're eating alone. This is completely reversed in places like France, where 80% of meals are taken with other people. And so I won't even go into, like, why that's important. Don't even try to say that's because, oh, the French are lazy and, you know, the Europeans just don't do work all day, because that's completely not true. The point I'm trying to make here is that our low value placed on food has led to an attempt to minimize the amount of time we spend on it. So then, if we think about those two issues of why we don't cook and all the benefits that, you know, outweigh those, what strategies can we effectively employ that address the majority of those issues? Think of it like the 80-20 rule of the kitchen, so to speak. So I was surprised to find out over years of reading, cooking, talking with other chefs, that it actually takes very little to become self-sufficient with cooking. And really this method, air quotes, it's really more of a mindset. And it's built on one key principle, flexibility. So if we think of this as like the hidden apron method, that's the whole point. And it extends to three other areas: flexibility and technique, and equipment, which promotes creativity, flexibility in ingredients, which promotes locality, and flexibility in ability. Wow, that's like a mouthful to say. It promotes more people cooking. So we'll go into each of those, starting with equipment. And these are now we move into the actual strategies and frameworks to use. Starting with equipment, I can't count how many times I've seen these promoted posts on Facebook or social media, or like advertisements for kitchen equipment that I have no reason needing, due to like either it's super, super expensive or it's a highly specific use. Usually you'll see them on infomercials, right? They're hilarious. For example, an egg slicer or some high-tech ice cream machine that can only be used to, well, obviously make ice cream. There are tons of articles out there that tell you the top 10 pieces of equipment you should buy, and oftentimes you'll end up shelling hundreds of dollars to get every piece on it. And instead, the way I like to think about it is in terms of characteristics rather than the actual tool itself. You only need tools to cover certain uses and characteristics, and if you have one tool that covers them all, then that's the only tool you need, right? So first off, if you're writing down as a checklist, and you could see this in the deck once it's posted up, you need some sort of vessel or a collection of vessels that collectively can be, one, heated throughout, two, hold enough food, and enough is up to your definition, and three, it can be reused. So for example, if you have a large pot with a lid that can fit in your fridge, this might be the only item you need because it covers all three of those uses. But let's say you have a pot, it doesn't have a lid, so you can't really store it. Then you might need to buy some Tupperware to cover you off so that you can get all those check marks on those requirements. Or maybe you own a skillet that you can't heat in the oven because it has a rubber handle. Then maybe you need some disposable aluminum roasting pans to supplement your toolbox. So for starters, when I began, when I moved here in New York 3 years ago, I actually started with just one oven-safe pot, one pan that I bought in New York's Lower East Side, by the way, for like less than $50. Best thing possible. If you could find a restaurant supply store near you, perfect. Yeah, those things I'm still using like 3 years later. It's definitely paid itself back. Next up, utensils. So are you stressing over what 10-piece knife set to get? I would say screw it. The only thing your utensils have to do is, one, slice, two, mix, and three, grip. And whether that's food or equipment, leave it up to you. So it's something like tong-like for the former, or oven mitt if you're doing something with equipment, you could say. So let's say you only have a spoon to mix. Perfect. You have chopsticks and no spoon? Not a problem. You went out and bought a fancy whisk because you wanted to? Hey, you know what? Good for you. I actually started with just one chef's knife and was the most expensive thing in my cabinet for like $100, a little bit more, for more than a year. Like, that was my only knife. I had a couple of spoons and forks, a pair of tongs, a towel, and a good surface to chop on. Usually, for most people, that would be a chopping board. After utensils, storage. You ever see those ads for like these are hilarious. I make it sound like I watch all these infomercials, but you know those like 30-piece interlocking, vacuum sealing, electronic, counts how many calories you put in plastic containers? Like, they're ridiculous. You never know when you're going to lose a lid anyway, and who has room in their cabinet for all that? Honestly, if you have something that can be warmed / frozen, fit into whatever location space you have, whether that's the fridge, counter, pantry, whatever, and have the ability to conform to the shape of food or fold, you're good. That might mean you have a combination of foil, cheap plastic quart containers, like the kind you get from when you order like Chinese takeout and like the sweet and sour soup comes with it, or Ziploc bags. If you count all these things, whether the vessel, the utensils, the storage, if you count all the equipment costs for the above, you can definitely get all of that for less than $200. And keep in mind, I survived on this very list throughout college when I didn't know how to cook. My first year living in a broom closet in New York, where I barely knew how to cook. And I believe most of the people listening to this already have more than enough considering this checklist. So I wanted to simply illustrate how easy it is to begin cooking. So as part of the essentials, I also want to add spices and flavorings. And why? For the most part, if you look at recipes, they list spices that you need, and what tends to happen is you end up buying all these specialty spices like Aleppo chili or like salt made from the tears of 300 angels that you don't even end up using for other dishes just because you might not know how or the other dishes don't call for them. And so maintaining a spice rack based on recipes makes it extremely expensive. It's prone to going stale. So instead, by focusing on key flavors, you can substitute and enhance as many dishes as you'd like while still making sure a dish is balanced. For that, I focus on something salty. You could have salt, soy sauce, fish sauce, shrimp paste, as long as you have something salty. Number two, something sour. You could use fresh citrus fruits. I like to use vinegars. I think as a Filipino, vinegar is like a key component to our cuisine. Or someone actually brought this up to me the other day, sour ale. Three, something sweet, whether it's sugar, and there's so many kinds of sugar, or fresh fruit. Lastly, a fat to cook in, and that's what really adds the richness when needed. I like using Kerrygold grass-fed butter or any oil with a high smoke point, right? I think Rachel Ray, or man, I really don't want to like call out certain people on TV, but we've been led to believe like extra virgin olive oil is the best to cook with, but it burns so easily that you really shouldn't be using it as your primary cooking fat. So with those flavorings as a foundation, you could create a ton of variations without ever having to think of other spices just yet, like paprika or the Indian asafoetida. Google that. That's actually a really, really interesting and pungent spice. I think it translates to like devil's dung, and there's a reason why they call it that. But it's an amazing, amazing ingredient. Some of these getting later on, no problem, because that'll broaden your flavor horizons. But at the very start, as long as you have something salty, sour, sweet, and a fat, you're good. So now we've got our kitchen set up. We have our equipment. We have our basics and our essentials. We can now move on to the actual recipe. And so notice I said that in singular, right? And I'm going to be quite bold here and definitively state that you only need one recipe to start and continue to cook for many years. If you have this one recipe, you can create countless other variations that I guarantee you will keep you from getting bored while also making cooking fun and fulfilling. So here's the recipe. You might need like a piece of paper and pen, because this is, you're gonna have to write this down. All right, here it goes. Protein plus starch plus vegetable equals dish. That's it. Like, seriously, I'm not kidding. That's the recipe that I've followed for such a long time now. And why this format, right? Because you might think like, oh, that's not a recipe. Like, what are the ingredients? So to answer that question of why I see that as the basis of every recipe you need is, I think it's best to see first why other recipes don't cut it, especially if you're a beginner to cooking. I was reading this recipe that I found on a popular online cooking resource written by a very famous chef. I looked at how many ratings it got. Everyone rated as like a 5-star dish. It tasted great. It was labeled as an easy recipe, and it featured a pretty long list of ingredients, and it called for like a specific type of fish. I think it was like Pacific cod or something like that. Well, first of all, one, what if you don't have Pacific cod, right? Some of the ingredients in there were like julienne carrots. Like, what the hell is a julienne? It also called for a 12-inch skillet. Well, what if I don't have a skillet? Or it says, like, heat it to high. Well, what does high mean? And so I think recipes basically are a little bit too restrictive, and they're not user-friendly for a beginner, that even when you're experienced in cooking, I mostly use those for inspiration now and just trying to see what are the flavor components and then tweaking them as an actual basis for the cooking. I think recipes lead to this mindset of having to be super, super precise. I love the term that Amy Bessa, who we also interviewed for the podcast coming out soon, she owns Purple Yam in Brooklyn. She called it like the tyranny of rules. So if we make things general enough, you can confidently go into any store, green market, and pick yourself out ingredients without stressing if a certain ingredient isn't there. So for example, your local fish market does not have Chilean sea bass. Well, why not use red snapper or maybe shrimp or maybe straight up just beans. I think one of the beauties of shopping local and seasonal is this ever-changing produce, and sometimes this has unfairly been the cause of a lot of stress for beginner cooks because they don't think through substitutions. They're like, I got to get everything on this list. But I think if you use this general recipe of protein plus starch plus vegetable equals dish, and it's really more like a framework, we're able to cook with more ease, with more creativity, and it's generally just more flexible, going back to, again, the main principle of the hidden apron method. So let's set this aside for now, and we'll talk a little bit more about technique first, and what we can then do with the actual ingredients. So another problem with current recipes is that technique is often not considered when looking at the recipes themselves. And by that, I mean that the recipe usually highlights ingredients or uses some nice photos, puts a nice story. But I don't think they actually call out, hey, this involves a technique that it's easier to mess up, or it takes a lot of skill, and if you make like the slightest mistake, you're going to end up with a plate of burnt crap that will discourage you from cooking. And I think as a beginner, getting those early wins was key for me when trying to learn how to cook. And trying to find recipes that involve techniques with the highest margin of error was what really helped a lot. And here's what I mean by margin of error. If a technique allows you to deviate from the recipe and still taste good, I don't know, my like Filipino accent's coming out, you've got wiggle room, right? That's your margin for error. One example of that is braising. Like, I love to braise because that's where you, by the way, cook something half submerged in a liquid until it's tender. So think of like a stew. Because if you happen to braise a half hour too long, an hour too long, nothing really bad will happen. In fact, you're probably going to end up with more tender meat if you're roasting like or braising a thick cut of meat. However, on the opposite end, if you're searing an expensive cut of delicate fish, if your heat is just a little bit too low, the fish will soak up a ton of oil, get soggy, and the skin will fall off. Or like if the heat is too high, you risk burning the thing and you don't get this nice, firm, flaky cut. Right? Like every second almost counts. So always be assessing the techniques that are required for your meal. Do I have wiggle room? If not, do I have the skills and time to practice this right now? Because if you don't and you're trying to get dinner out, techniques really do matter. Time, however, is not the only consideration here because, yes, it is one of the most important, but another one is equipment and skill. Because another question you could ask is, does this technique require the skillful use of a certain piece of equipment? So, sure, roasting in your oven, it's not that hard. You can set and forget it. But roasting a child-sized pig using a hand-built campfire and spit, that's pretty tough. Of course, this is an extreme example. I think if you want to read more about this, I definitely recommend Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Chef. He talks about margin for error in there, and he lays out what I think is a pretty good curriculum of progression going from highest margin of error to least. And so this is actually where I got that concept from, and he lays it out quite nicely. So same thought process of margin for error. If we think about our ingredients the same way, hearty root vegetables, thicker cuts of meat with lots of fat, they're harder to mess up since they've already got a lot of flavor compounds in them, and you could cook them for a longer period of time, so you're less prone to burning them or just messing them up. On the other hand, if you get a boneless, skinless chicken breast, which for some reason is super popular here, it actually requires more attention and help to make sure it doesn't dry out or remain bland, given that you've already taken out the good parts, right? The skin and the bone are the ones that have the flavor. So it just, sometimes I just don't get why people buy boneless, skinless chicken breast, but to each their own. Same thing with super delicate vegetables that you can overcook and it turns to mush too easily. So as a summary, thinking of margin for error, pick ingredients and techniques that have a high margin of error so that you're able to increase your chances of a successful and tasty meal. And by the way, easy does not mean less tasty. From there, once you've developed the confidence to tackle harder techniques, then you could certainly move to harder ingredients that require more attention and skill. But in the beginning, it's all about increasing your chances of winning, right? That's how to increase the likelihood that you will continue a habit, especially one as important as cooking. So let's try to put this into more concrete terms and dishes, and how this actually looks in practice. Let's take, for example, 5 completely different dishes from different parts of the world. The iconic Filipino adobo, just made this a couple days ago. which is meat, usually stewed in vinegar. Feijoada, which is a Brazilian dish made with different cuts of pork. It has black beans. It looks very different from the adobo. Dal makhni, which is a Indian curry made with lentils and red kidney beans. The sukiyaki ramen from Japan, which features ramen noodles and thin slices of beef. And finally, the good old Irish corned beef and cabbage. Now, if you look at these dishes side by side, and Google them, by the way, because I think it makes them a lot more real when you see just how different they are, you might think of them as completely different dishes requiring completely different recipes, and they're like five distinct things in your head. However, using the framework we've just been outlining, all of these dishes conform to a general set of rules. So remember that recipe formula I mentioned about a while ago, right? Protein plus starch plus veg equals dish. Well, all of these dishes actually conform to that. For the protein, adobo uses chicken. Feijoada uses pork. Dal uses lentils. Sukiyaki ramen uses beef. And corned beef is, well, self-explanatory, right? For starch, adobo, feijoada, dal, they're served with rice. Sukiyaki has the noodles. Corned beef is eating with potatoes. For vegetable, you range anywhere from having just onions in adobo. You could have carrots, okra, collard greens, and feijoada. Peas with your dal, peppers and seaweed for the ramen. And again, I don't know why this is like a pattern, but cabbage is self-explanatory for the corned beef. And they're all pretty much cooked the same way. They're braised in a liquid over low heat. The biggest difference here, and this is why I covered spices a while ago as part of your basic essentials, are that the flavorings are different between each. The spices you use are going to be different. And that's really where the creativity comes in, right? Because, but most of it, the 80%, are pretty much the same. Other than that, yeah, they're significantly more similar than you think. Had you gone to like a recipe website and tried to look these things up. So that, I think that's pretty cool, right? Reducing dishes to these basic elements helps you get more access to these dishes that you would have thought like, oh, I can't do that. That's totally different from what I know. So I think from there, it becomes much more simpler to now begin making your own menus, constructing dishes, coming up with your own meals. I perform this exercise, by the way, at work. So for the ones who are listening to this again, it's basically just summarizing what we did, where I basically had people shout out random ingredients to basically create, I need to stop saying basically create a hypothetical mystery basket of sorts, kind of like what you see if you watch the TV show Chopped. So I'm just going to kind of go through what we did real quick so you could just see how easy this exercise can be and that anyone can really do it. So using the menu formula, again, protein plus starch plus vegetable, we came up with chicken as a protein, tortillas and quinoa as the starch, a whole wide range of vegetables from carrots, cauliflower, cilantro, and when we talked about flavor profile, again, think of it as one salty, one sweet, one sour, one fat, in different varying degrees of amounts, we came up with Himalayan pink sea salt, sour ale, cumin, salt, pepper, and lard. And see how we specifically did not come up with a perfect scenario list of items? It's because that's really how real life works. You literally walk into a farmer's market and pick out things that would meet the criteria without looking for anything specific, because you never really know what's going to be there unless you spend most of your time in a grocery store, and that's completely fine. That actually makes it a lot easier for you. And so with these ingredients, let's say that I only have one pot, one pan for equipment, along with the usual knife and utensils. How would I go about prepping this mystery basket as a beginner? Well, following the guidelines of increasing chances of success and choosing techniques that increase those chances, I would probably cook the quinoa in the pot first so you can clear it out and use it to cook the chicken, which takes more time. If you've got the time, you could also marinate the chicken with the spices plus the sour ale. And notice I didn't specify the exact proportion of spices, which I think many recipes do, because that's where you come in, right? These are flavor profiles that you should decide on depending on your taste. Maybe you don't like a lot of cumin, or you're a salt freak like me. Like, there's no really wrong way to do it around here, especially if you're starting to cook. After that, I would boil or braise the chicken. And while that's happening, I would chop up the vegetables in any way that I want. I mean, I would maybe throw out a fancy French term at you, but that's not going to happen right now. I would saute them with the lard on a pan in high heat, whatever high means to you, going from the toughest veggies first, like carrots, and then moving to the softer ones until you end up with a big pan of sauteed veggies. So once you've got all your components cooked, you pretty much have the basis for chicken tacos or a burrito, right? You shred your chicken, place it on your tortillas, top it with the quinoa and veggies, add whatever other seasonings you'd like, and boom. That's pretty damn simple, I would say, thinking about it from the perspective of, like, I don't know what ingredients I'm going to walk through in. So from now on, when trying to figure out what to cook, sure, go ahead. Read a few recipes for general inspiration. I do this too. But honestly, you don't need much more than a simple framework to begin going to your favorite markets, seeing what's local, seeing what's fresh, seasonal, and begin crafting your meals. You might actually start finding yourself going to these farmers markets more because you'll find the produce is just much better. There's more variety. There's things that you might never have seen before. Especially living in New York, we're blessed to have a lot of green markets. So take advantage of those. A couple of things I want to note as I wrap things up. I think I've talked long enough on the issue. A few common challenges you might face. Mise en place. It's basically a French fancy term for getting your cooking space in order. You know, you ever try cooking where like half your stuff is still in the plastic bag while you're cooking, so you end up forgetting something near the end, or perhaps you didn't set out things to put prep stuff into, like those little bowls or plastic containers, so you kind of just toss them into the pot to clear up space, and you end up overcooking certain things because you tossed them in at the wrong time. Or maybe your place is just so messy. You got the lard on the floor, you trip, you knock into the gas stove, you spill food all over the place, the propane canister ignites on the stove and explodes, and the roof catches on fire, and you get this expensive hospital bill, and you ruin your life. Yeah, get your space in order. It's a big deal. I think it's one way that restaurants are able to cook in such large volumes, because mise en place is extremely, extremely, extremely important. So ways you can do that. Set up those cheap Chinese takeout soup courts to separate your prepped ingredients for easy access. You could use a plastic lined bowl as a scrap bowl, so you don't have to keep making trips to your trash can. You could literally just toss some scraps as you go. Prep in the sequence of your cooking. So if you're looking at a recipe, you don't have to chop everything as it's listed in your recipes, because you could actually shorten your prep time by prepping it in a particular order. So those who've read the Toyota Way, us in business school had to read this, or just-in-time manufacturing, or Six Sigma, which are all like supply chain operation concepts, but you might be familiar with this, but it applies to cooking as well. So for example, let's say you have a dish where you have to roast some meat that needs trimming, and you're going to pair this with sauteed vegetables and mashed potatoes. You can certainly prep everything at once, right? You could trim the meat, then cut all the vegetables, then cut the potatoes or whatnot, but I think that means a lot of downtime for you because you're having to wait for food to cook. Instead, you can set the potatoes to boil right away, and while that's boiling, you could trim the meat, put that in the roast, and so while that's roasting, you can prep your veggies, so there's overall less time spent. So that's what I mean by, you know, cooking in that particular order and making sure you have your mise en place. Like, one more time, get your place in order. Another challenge that arises, and that's why we've already covered this earlier, is focusing too much on specific ingredients rather than ingredient families, because that causes you to fail to substitute. And you can eliminate this by following the dish framework up top, so that the next time something calls for a potato and you don't have one on hand, you can consider other similar starches, rice, pasta. Yes, this is a loose approach that promotes creativity and flexibility. But the other thing I want to add, other than just like failing to substitute, is the opposite end, which is failing to plan. Yes, be loose, but also take care not to underplan. Consider how much time you actually be in the kitchen, whether you're going to be able to finish all the food you cook, like you could eat it all. And one thing to prevent that is to cook in building blocks, or in geek speak, modules. By that, I mean components that, if you rearrange them, can actually form entirely new dishes. So an example would be you can roast chicken, veggies, and cook rice. One night, you might just eat them as plain chicken with veg on rice. The next day, you might make a soup out of some of the chicken and vegetables. The next day, you might fry some of the rice and veggies for like a light stir fry. And by the way, you could cook these in components over several days, you know, interchanging in and out. So this helps reduce your boredom, which is a common excuse for not cooking. Lastly, and this is, I think, a often overlooked challenge when it comes to food, is that food should be fun. And especially in America, sometimes that gets lost when you're cooking as opposed to eating out, because it's seen as almost an impediment to productivity. But food should just be fun, because it has so much power to fulfill more than our stomachs. So if you take it too seriously, you're feeling like, oh my God, this is huge, overwhelming thing that I have to get right 100% at the first go, it's just not going to do you any good. In fact, you're more likely to give up on it during times of failure. So knowing that, keeping it chill, think of it almost like working out, right? You wouldn't quit after your first failed set. Like, even if you screw up, you could probably salvage the meal or order takeout if it's really extreme and try again, right? There's always tomorrow. You eat 3 times a day, you can do this again. Whew, okay. I pretty much got through it. Wow, I spoke for quite some time. I didn't know I would reach nearly the 1 hour mark. This is a lot of info, especially since it's me trying to condense what I've experimented, learned, read throughout six to seven years of fooling around, all into one podcast episode. So if there's ever any area you'd like me to dive deep into or get someone professional to actually speak on, do let me know. Send us an email, tweet us. I'm always eating out around here in New York, so if you're ever in the area, hit me up. I'd be glad to just break bread, right? So check the show notes of this episode, hiddenapron.com/podcast. I'm going to attach a couple more resources and links. They have everything from books I really like, including the ones I mentioned earlier, blogs to follow, shows to watch. And by the way, all of them are skewed towards answering this need for us to become more proficient cooks without all the glam and glitter, right? I think these culinary competition shows, lifestyle blogs, all the food porn, they're great. Like, I enjoy them regularly, and there's definitely a need for them in the overall culinary landscape. But when trying to learn the basis of cooking, some resources are just better than others. With that said, I'm going to wrap this episode up. I hope you got some good use of things you could start using in your daily life pretty soon. I'd love to hear how you've tested them out, if I'm completely off on the mark. Yeah, I really suck at endings, but thanks for listening, and catch you on the next episode.